Committee on General Government. It's Monday, April the 25th, and I am going to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5059, the Public Employees Retirement System. This is an opportunity for public testimony, and I presume there is a sign-in. There is a sign-in sheet in the back. And with us this morning is the director, Mr. Clary. Good morning, Mr. Clary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS, Public Employee Retirement System. I've only brought two of my management team with me here, Brian DeForest, our Budget Manager, and Steve Delaney, our Deputy Director and Legislative Coordinator. Assuming that we can handle your questions, we'll do it with this team of three. If there's some detail that we can't respond to, we'll prepare responses for tomorrow or bring in the subject matter experts. As you know, Madam Chair, my offices are located up in Tigard, and I thought it would be better to leave my administrators up there working with the troops.
It's a fine call. I waved as I went by this morning.
Thank you. I just want to point out in your notebooks, and I'm working off of the one that's budget presentation document phase two. In the front of it, we've got the response to questions from our phase one presentation. There were a number of questions that needed some research, statistics on how many visitors we've got at the Salem office, what our participation is in the various e-government initiatives, management to staffing ratios, the hiring process that we've gone through, and I would point out, of course, we've got a significant number of limited duration positions, and with limited duration positions, you will see a lot of churn with those, and I think we had about 130 positions, and a combination of those plus the permanent hires, which would include things like my own, we actually hired some 400 positions, which is almost the total amount, or is the total amount of staff that we've got up there. We didn't hire 400 new people, but we hired for some positions three or four times because over the period of the 2 years, we had that amount of churn. We also had...
Mr. Clark, yes, ma'am. Let me stop and ask you. You had that amount of, as you're referring to it, as churn, and that's probably a pretty good word. What caused that? It couldn't have just been the limited duration nature of the positions with that many, was it? Or were there other operative factors?
Well, Madam Chair, we had a percentage of the limited duration positions were for less than 24 months. And I can't tell you right off the top of my head, but I know that we had 6-month positions, we had 12-month positions. And so those, of course, you would expect to see those disappear. And then with limited duration folks, when they'll come in, if they see an opportunity, if a permanent position opens, and of course we experience, like a number of agencies, experience the spike in retirement within our own workforce as well. So those permanent positions eventually opened up after we'd left them vacant for the required time period and got the vacancy savings. So people who were in limited duration that were qualified were certainly looking to move and did move, and then we had to hire behind them. And then, of course, as the economy strengthens, you know, we do lose people to the private sector and to other government agencies. And so we'll continue to kind of see that. It's settled down a little bit, and I would hope that going forward into the next biennium, we could have a more stable workforce. But it is an issue, and you'll see one of our budget packages is the need to have the human resource capabilities to do this kind of hiring and screening that's required for that level of turnover.
One of the things when we get to the packages that you might want to just think about apropos your last remark, mm-hmm. and that is agencies have been coming forward to the subcommittees asking for additional positions, and the question was raised in another committee, and it's one that I'd like to follow up on, to make the positions limited until certain performance measures are demonstrated and then come back to the next session and convert them to full FTE if you needed to. And I don't need you to answer right now, but to just reflect on what the upsides and the downsides of that kind of a scenario would be for you. Were you given positions in policy option packages, but they were limited duration?
Be happy to when we get to that. We also have got some detail, about 3 pages of detail, on our retiree health insurance program. This program insures somewhere around 47,000 people. It's both retired members as well as their beneficiaries, and I'll go into some more details on that as I get into the program unit that is covered under. And then the final attachment is just a clip. I had referred to an article out of the National Association of State Retirement Administrators News Clipping Service. It's a San Francisco Chronicle article dated January 7th, 2005. That compares retirement benefits California, Texas, Oregon, Illinois, and Florida. And the committee members were interested in an actual copy of that article, so we just included that for your information. So you'll recall, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that when I appeared before you a month and a half ago or 2 months ago, I indicated that the three biggest challenges that we are facing at PERS are implementing the new pension plan components, the House Bill 2020 pension plan components, which is the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, and the individual account program, that's our defined contribution program now, implementing those and integrating them into our ongoing agency operations, which requires coordination with our legacy Tier 1 and Tier 2 pension plan components. That was our first challenge. Our second was completing the implementation and configuration of our new information technology platform, which is known as the J-Clarity platform, both for administration of the House Bill 2020 pension plan components, as well as over the next 44 months, using that same platform to convert our legacy IT system, our Retirement Information Management System, also known as RIMS, converting that over to this J-Clarity platform. And then third, completing the processing of the record number of retirements that we experienced over the last 18 months and addressing the backlogs associated with them, as well as any of the accumulated workloads. Doing those three things while at the same time keeping the doors open and the floor swept for ongoing retirements. I'm hopeful that we don't look back on 2003 through 2005 as the good old days. We have been handed a new curveball, if you will, the Supreme Court's, Oregon Supreme Court's decision in the Strunk litigation that will require us to go back and do a number of calculations over again. And as I tell my staff, we want to get good at doing calculations, but hopefully we don't have to do them three times to get good at them. But we'll cover that in more detail as I go through this. But obviously we've got an environment that continues to change, and changes in manners that we don't have a lot of control over. That requires us to be very flexible, very adaptable, and to try to get ahead of the curve wherever we've got an opportunity. I think you'll see in our budget packages that's exactly what we're trying to do. I would point out, Madam Chair, that our board chair is going to be able to join us tomorrow morning, Mike Pittman. So I'll let Mike talk some about the PERS board, the challenges that they faced when he came on, and some of the concerns that they see going forward. I'd turn now to kind of page 6 and 7 of our presentation.
Mr. Corey, in anticipation of Mr. Pittman's visit, could you tell us a little bit about your board structure right now? They're gubernatorial appointees confirmed by the Senate, but
right.
If you could tell us anything more, remuneration, amount of time serving.
I'd be happy to, ma'am, and the remuneration is easy. It's volunteer. If you look on page 4, you'll have a listing of our current board. We have three private sector members, and those individuals cannot have any connection to PERS or a beneficiary of PERS. And that's Mike Pittman, who's Executive Vice President for Human Resources for Scottish Power, James Dalton, who is a senior vice president for development for Tektronix, and Eva Kripalani, who is vice president and general counsel for Knowledge Learning Corporation. That used to be KinderCare and was merged with a Knowledge Learning Corporation. Pleased to say that the headquarters actually relocated from Denver up to Portland, and so Eva will continue to serve. Our state manager member is Brenda Rockland, president of the State Accident Insurance Fund, SAFE. And then our public employee member is Tom Grimsley. And Tom is a middle school teacher down in the Bethel School District down in Eugene. In my 9 months of experience with this board, I've been incredibly impressed with their dedication, the depth of experience that they bring, the willingness to ask the hard questions and challenge us. They challenge us hard on budget issues. They challenge us on operational issues. They're looking for efficiencies. They're trying to bring the experience that they've had both in the public and private sector to improve our operations, and I certainly appreciate it. I think you'll see that tomorrow.
I'll give you the background of what I'm reflecting on, and it's the question right now, of course, of what might be the future of PGE, and there are different models that are being proposed, and sort of contemplating what do you do about these public boards that have enormous fiduciary responsibilities, and yours would certainly be one of them. When you think about the strictures that are now being imposed on corporate boards with Sarbanes-Oxley and some of those other requirements, and trying to analogize the very rigorous or the increasingly rigorous oversight of private sector boards with a board such as yours that has under its direct management a total of
$50 billion.
Yeah, $50
billion. $50 billion retirement fund.
And trying to figure out how do you find people who will fulfill these responsibilities and do it in a way that serve the state, but also recognize the tremendous fiduciary responsibilities associated with particularly these appointments.
Well, I think the way you find them is you don't tell them everything about it when you first talk to them. I remember telling my board members I used to have a poster in Wyoming and I lost it in the move. It had an old grizzled cowboy and he's looking out from underneath his hat and he's going, there's a heck of a lot about this outfit they didn't tell me when I hired on. And that's kind of what we try to do with this. These guys, they thought that it was a 12-hour a month job. It started turning into about a 20-hour a week job, and they do have their own day jobs as well, and that's throughout both the private sector and the public sector members as well. I know Tom Grimsley told me one time that he's starting to dream about just being a teacher again. And what we try to do is make their service as focused and simple as possible in terms of time demands, because that's significant. And these are unpaid positions. You are looking at people that basically are volunteering their service to the state, and doing work that you're not going to please everybody. As a matter of fact, we do a pretty good job of not pleasing anybody. And that's tough, because when you're in a position, you like to try to deliver good news, but when you have to continually deliver bad news, or you've got people suing you from both sides like we continue to have, that's tough on them both personally and professionally. But again, I think that if this is an indication of the kind of talent that you can draw to the service of volunteer boards, I wouldn't be fearful about using it in other scenarios.
In your interaction with your board, I know that they're two different animals, but do you ever review any of the requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley to give you any guidance in selection of folks or in your relationship with them or in their relationship with the institution?
Madam Chair, our three private sector members are intimately familiar with that, and as a matter of fact, they serve as our audit committee, our board audit committee, and in their own occupations they're intimately familiar with it and want to see the same level of rigor brought to both our response to internal and external audits.
Representative Favakian.
We just spent a couple minutes talking about how you dupe these folks into serving. I thought it might be appropriate for you to just spend a minute talking about how you help prepare them for managing an amount of money that virtually nobody in the world ever, you know, has an opportunity to manage.
I'm glad you raised that, Representative Bakian. I would point out that we do have a bifurcation of responsibilities here in Oregon. While the board is the trustees for the operation and the system as a whole, we do use the Oregon Investment Council for investment of the funds. Now, there's a provision where one of the PERS board members will serve on the Oregon Investment Council as well to provide that direct connection. In the interim here, that role is being served by Mark Gardner, who was already on the Oregon Investment Council. But we meet, and I'm an ex officio member of the Oregon Investment Council. We have the Treasury staff come and present quarterly to the PERS board. We share monthly statistics with them. They are interested in what's going on the fund side, and we will meet as a joint board to deal with the asset and liability study. But here in Oregon, we do have this kind of separation of duties. And when I look at what's going on in other systems, I think it's actually a pretty good design, because some of the systems that have really gotten in trouble have been working both sides of the equation, the benefit side and the investment side, and have been perhaps overly optimistic in both, whereas we've got some checks and balances.
Let me just make sure I understand this. Mark Gardner, who sits on the Investment Council, is ex officio to your board.
Madam Chair, Mark is our representative on the Oregon Investment Council until his term runs out. And then, if I can talk one of my PERS board members into wearing another hat and serving on the Investment Council, we'll have someone serving directly. And in the past, when the PERS board had 12 members, they could split these duties up pretty easily, and they did actually have Mark serving on both. But so the provision was made when we dropped to five that we wouldn't require a new board member to go on to the OIC, I think until 07, 08, somewhere in there. We'll get the exact date for you. But I'm the ex officio member on the OIC. On the Oregon Investment Council, so I'm on both meetings, and then Mark is our kind of our board connection as well.
Beyond the private sector requirement and the state manager requirement and the beneficiary requirement, are there any other minimum qualifications?
Madam Chair, within the statutes, it talks about the people that are familiar with financial management, human resources, and benefit administration, and that's exactly the kind of mix that we were able to attract here.
Please continue.
It's okay.
This is the largest fund that the state manages.
Madam Chair, yes, it is. As a matter of fact, I think we're in the top 25. Nationally and in the top 50 internationally, PERS fund is. But I think in total there's somewhere around 70 billion, maybe managed 65 billion, and we're 50 billion of it here. You've got the SAFE fund, the Common School Fund, and some of the others.
Now, please continue.
I turn to page 6 and 7 then, and again, some of the factors that we were facing, I described those on page 6 in our in my opening remarks. I would point out that, as I indicated, the Supreme Court decision on the Strunk case is going to require us to do adjustments to some 22,000 individual member accounts. These are transactions, retirements, divorces, disabilities that we have to go back and touch because of the strong case. And I'll talk some more about another pending case that could add substantially to that. On page 7, I just wanted to show people, you know, the full suite of reform legislation. What was involved in the Strunk ruling was House Bill 2003 and House Bill 2004. So House Bill 2001 was unaffected by that ruling. House Bill, Senate Bill 258, Measure 29 on the pension obligation bond, and House Bill 2020. All of those unaffected, all of those we project to continue to generate savings going forward. But within what was ruled on the Strunk case, it was, as I think the newspaper accounts indicated, a split decision. There were four major features. Two of them got overturned. The prohibiting Tier 1 regular account crediting had a large projected savings with it, but this is the one where the savings would be created by both the court upholding the provision as well as the fund earning 8% or less. So it was kind of exposed both to market risk as well as litigation risk. And by the time the court ruled, the market had already pretty much closed out a number of those savings. This was based on the fact that we thought it was going to take us 4 years to pay off the $1.9 billion Tier 1 deficit account. Instead, because of good earnings, we were paying that off in about an 18-month period. So I'll go into some more detail on the effects of this. But
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain, Paul, the $4.5 billion Tier 1 regular account crediting and then the COLA freeze of $415 million as it relates to your increased earnings? Are these numbers the net of increased earnings?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, no, they're not. The Tier 1 regular account crediting got reduced to about $2.1 billion was the effect of that because the increased earnings at all was the effect of the Strunk overturning it because the increased earnings had already taken a number of those savings. And the COLA freeze estimate actually was turned out to be an underestimate. It came in now at more around $700 million, losing that because we had a lot more retirements than we anticipated when this projection was developed. So, and I'll go into some more detail in that as I get back into the remainder of the presentation. But I did just want to include this this slide so people could be aware that there still are a number of reform legislation components in effect, and we still anticipate substantial savings going forward, particularly from the new retirement plan that applies to all individuals hired after August 29th, 2003. Page 8 and 9 are just our program priority list, and the committee is familiar with these as we went through this when we came back in for our second go-round. And so I think agency-wide summary, it's been an interesting biennium for us, new legislation, a new board, new executive management. We've got a number of new objectives, a new mission. We've been reorganizing divisions and staff, trying to implement both a real rigorous project management approach as well as strategic and tactical planning. We're looking at best practices in other state retirement systems. And you'll recall we shared with you a peer review study called Cost Effectiveness Management, CEM. And we've got our ranking in that, frankly, is pretty poor. But it does allow us to benchmark ourselves against our peers and to see whether what we're putting in place today is going to create the kind of dramatic improvements that we anticipate them to create. We're developing, again, new performance measures and expect to have those in place 2007, 2009. So with that kind of recap, I might just launch right into the governor's recommended budget, Madam Chair, if that's okay.
Any questions from the committee? I think then we'll invite you to do that.
Thank you. I'm turning now on page 12. This is our program unit for Chapter 238. That's our Tier 1, Tier 2 retirement plan. And what this shows is the other fund non-limited expenditures that we anticipate for retirement benefits. Now, when we say retirement, that includes, of course, retirement, death, disability, withdrawals, any time when there's money that is pulled out of the system. I'd note that we're anticipating about $5.4 billion over the next biennium. I think for fiscal year 2004, our actual was about 2.6. So we're in that same ballpark. The second, page 13, our second program unit is our health insurance benefit unit. And again, this is other funds non-limited. We've got about $260 million for the pass-through of premium payments. Insurance premiums and administrative costs are paid by members. And there is a premium subsidy, which is employer-paid, that is $60 a month for those retirees that are eligible for Medicare. And I would point out that we currently have about 35,000 retirees that are eligible for Medicare. I think with their beneficiaries, that covers about 45,000 total lives. And then we've also got another subsidy program that only applies to 911 retirees. And this is for people with 8 to 30 years of service that, again, are funded by an employer assessment. The $60 a month bill is about $54 million a biennium, and this, what we call the RIPA, Retirement Health Insurance Premium Account, the 911 retirees, it's about $3.7 million there. We've got one package adjustment, and that's a BAM analyst adjustment to move our other funds non-limited for our program administration, our third-party program administration, which is about $4.6 million, move it from our operations unit into this program. Again, we're trying to get our budget better aligned with where the money's actually spent. And the next page is on page 14 is just the detailed numbers on that. As you see, again, this is all other fund non-limited. We then turn on page 15 to our new retirement plan, our Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, what we call Chapter 238A. This has got the individual account program, which is a member account treated as a defined contribution. This is where the member's 6% contribution is now directed. No investment guarantee, invested the same way as the rest of the fund, but no guaranteed return. I believe we're looking at about $370 million or so that flows in to those accounts on an annual basis. What we show here is anticipated expenditures for benefit payments, and we show $5.1 million. What we're trying to do here is show you that we know that we're going to have people that are going to retire that have individual accounts, as well as we're going to have people that came in late in their career and maybe only worked 2 or 3 years under this new plan, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. We'd have some withdrawals and some other things. So we've got a small limitation associated with this. Don't have a lot of experience with this new plan. And I'm assuming next biennium we'll come back in with much tighter numbers. But we wanted to make sure that we did have some ability to make payments for what we know is going to occur under both the IAP and the OPSERP. Small number compared to the others, but one that we need. On page 16, give you just a schematic of our entire organization and show you how I'm going to walk through the operations program unit. That's our other major program unit. You see we've got five divisions benefit payment division, customer services, financial services, information services, and policy planning and legislative analysis. On page 17, we've got kind of a summary of our entire operations budget. You'll note that we had a legislative approved budget for the last biennium, about $84 million, 401 positions, 356 FTE. Under the governor's recommended budget, our operations would drop to about $75 million. Total position count would drop as well. FTE count up slightly. We are requesting, and you'll note here under the budget development section, you see where 130 positions disappear. Those are the 130 limited duration positions. We're requesting that we have approval for 96 limited duration positions in the next biennium, and two permanent. So of that that total figure there, 98, you'll you see that 96 are limited duration, two of them are permanent. And then I'm going to go in detail through the policy packages, but this is just kind of the summary scorecard for you, as well as shows how we built the overall budget. Turning to now to page 18.
Senator Morse.
Excuse me, Paul. Maybe just a brief explanation of the difference between the central budget level and then your added on policy. I know your packages, I know you're going to talk about justification, but my understanding of the definition of a central budget level is what it means to maintain the program. And I assume we'll be getting into this, but I'm wondering really what it does mean.
I'll ask Dallas to comment, please.
In another term, it would be take away one-time costs, and that the essential budget level should be when the agency has everything up and running.
Normalized.
Normalized. Yeah. Okay. That would right. be what it would.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you, ma'am. Turning now to page 18, I'm going to start with the benefit payment division because they're kind of the end of the pipe, if you will. This is where we finalize our calculations for both benefits, death, disability, divorce. We do our pension roll. We also go back in and do adjustments to benefits as well as cost of living adjustments. And so you can see here's a division divided up into three different sections that cover those activities. Our first package is analyst adjustments, reductions in S&S to reflect the projected smart buy savings. That's a reduction of $17,500. The next package, and I would point out that this is a component of a larger package, and we wanted to break it out by division so you could see how we're going to spend these larger packages. But we title package 101 our PERS restructuring and support package. This provides funding under the first bullet for 10 limited duration positions to increase our capacity to process retirements from what is currently about a capacity to process about 4,000 a year without creating backlogs to a capacity to process 6,000. We've averaged about 6,500 over the last 4 years. We've got about 40,000 people eligible to retire. And so we certainly believe that over the next biennium we're going to be in this ballpark. And what we wanted to do was be able to handle those retirements without creating the kind of backlogs that you'll see later on require us to come back in future bienniums to try to catch up. The next bullet is our retiree application intake and validation team. This is a team that we established this last biennium. We're asking to continue that with five limited duration positions. Our effort here is to correct applications, review them and correct them at the front end to try to keep errors from compounding. And a lot of the errors that we have are either prior data entry errors or other problems that if we can catch at the beginning, we won't compound them all the way through the calculation. And then we've got the third bullet is one position for internal training. As we've discovered, you know, our experienced people have had a lot of on-the-job training, but the new folks that we bring in, we can't wait for them to pick it up over 10 years. We need to train them immediately and spend the kind of time that's required to get them up to speed within a three-month period, ideally. So we've got to have an actual training resource to do that. Package 103 addresses two backlogs that have developed over time. One of them is the member benefit payment adjustments and reconciliations. These are where we've got missing employment segments, other kind of challenges that retirees have to their notice of entitlement. When we complete the retirement calculation and we're no longer doing an estimated payment, we issue what's called a notice of entitlement. Retirees have got a 260-day period, I believe, to challenge all the information that's in that. And this could be something like, well, you missed 4 months of teaching time that I had back in 1975 with a school district, and it's been merged not once but maybe twice since 1975. So there's a lot of work involved in going back and doing these adjustments. And we're finding that about 15% of all our calculations fall into this category, and we want to eliminate that backlog and then again use the application intake and validation team to prevent it from occurring in the future wherever possible, recognizing that there's always going to be some problems that you won't catch until the back end. And then we've also got positions in this for resolving clearing account problems. These are problems that, the clearing account is our way of telling us that everything is clean with a calculation. When we end up with zero in the clearing account, we know that we've got no problem between a reserve transfer. We've got no problems with incomplete transactions, and the Secretary of State has been auditing us on this as part of our financial audit for the last several biennium, and has been expressing concerns about the fact that we've got a growing balance in this clearing account. And so this is one that we actually brought back some experienced retired staff to work half time on addressing this, and we're finding ways to deal with it. But it is it's kind of an accounting mechanism that we use to tell us that everything is clean, and we want to make sure that we don't have that backlog continuing to grow. Under the Reform Legislation Implementation Package 104, this is our continuation of limited duration positions that support full implementation of PERS reform. You'll note that I've got in italics the COLA benefit recalculation reinstatement. This is a STRUNK-related activity, and I just want to make sure you saw those as we went through it. This is one that we will no longer do as a result of the STRUNK ruling, because this was involved in the COLA freeze. So you'll see that italics pop up in some other areas. Again, page 20 is just the numbers associated with those different packages. We've got 21, 22, 23, and 24 showing the fiscal impact of the STRUNK decision. As we indicated, continuation of the COLA project is no longer necessary given the STRUNK ruling. However, we do have to go back in and do a number of recalculations. And we've determined that about an identical set of staff, both in terms of size and classification, would be required to make those adjustments. Excuse me. The net change is about 3 retirement counselor positions and then 8 positions in other divisions. And I'll walk through that with the committee here in page 22 and 23.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Before you do that, just as a precursor to it, there's still a case or two pending, isn't there? And do those cases have the chance of impacting what you're going to go through in 21 through 24?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, we're going to have to do this work regardless. We may have to do more work related to the Lipscomb ruling, the City of Eugene case. What the Strunk ruling said is you've got to go back and you've got to credit Tier 1 member accounts 8% for 2003 that you hadn't credited, and you've got to undo this COLA freeze that you had implemented. So it affects retirements that we processed after April of 2004, as well as all of those the 22,000 members that retired that we put a COLA freeze on. What Lipscomb or City of Eugene case may require, if the Supreme Court upholds Judge Lipscomb's ruling, is we're going to have to go back to 1999 and recalculate retirements. So that's a significant increase in our workload. And you'll see in the appendix we've actually got a comparison table that shows you the transactions that we have to do under Strunk, the transactions that we have to do under Lipscomb. But Strunk, we know we're going to have to do this at a minimum. We may have to do more. So given that, you know, I would turn again to page 22. You'll see here we're proposing to actually reduce that package. This is pulling out all of the resources associated with the COLA freeze. We then will have to add back in the positions to do the workload associated with Strunk, and here's where you see that net gain of 10 positions. And on page 24, we net the whole thing out. It's 11 positions. So we've got a reduction on page 23, or page 22, an addition on page 23, and the net effect are these 11 positions and about $1.7 million. And again, when we get back into the appendix, I'll show you some detail on how we calculate those. And this is with us, you know, attempting to implement Strunk in a 2-year period. We believe that's a reasonable time period to do it, and we want to be committed to trying to complete it in that biennium. Page 25 is our Information Services Division. You'll see that we break that out into 5 different sections, and obviously with our major technology projects, we've got some significant efforts involved in quality assurance. We're also attempting to improve our data, so we've got a data quality assurance section. Software engineering, again, is also a major section for us. Page 26, these are our division components of the policy packages for information services. First package is eliminating 7 positions that were originally approved by the November 2003 Emergency Board and then administratively frozen pending additional review. With the change in management at PERS, we got a new administrator for Information Services Division. We kind of took a new direction. We went from a design-build strategy for the RIMS conversion project to a commercial off-the-shelf system with configuration, and so we determined that we didn't need these positions. We never requested them, and the proposal here is to eliminate them from our base budget, and we're fine with that. Package 103 is the Information Services Division share of our backlog effort, and this is no positions associated with this. This would be contract dollars to provide the technology and programming support. Package 104 is continuation of 6 limited duration positions for desktop services and other technology support for implementing PERS reform. Package 105 covers technology initiatives. We're continuing 8. I believe these are office assistant ones that are involved in our limited duration positions that are involved in our imaging and information management section. Here is where we take our documents. Right now, in the past, we were microfilming every document that we had and then having to develop an index for that when we came in and tried to research member information or employer reports. We had to go through that microfilm base. We now are imaging those documents and using them injecting them into the system so we can use an electronic workflow process instead of people having to call down to imaging, get a reprint off of a microfiche, move physical documents around. We image them, electronically image them, and they're then available to be worked on by a number of people just through the through our technology system. Second bullet is a request to add to positions, limited duration ISS 8 positions. These are high level IT positions, and we're requesting those because we are going to start assuming responsibility from our contractors for the maintenance, the documentation, the continued improvement of our new technology platform, JClarity. And so what we're asking for here is people who've got experience in what now is that new technology. Again, not a mainframe approach, a web-based approach. And our idea is that long-term, these folks will be key trainers, will be our key IT resources for that new platform.
As you're building your new platform, I would hope you could give the committee some assurance of security factors that are being taken into consideration given the undoubtedly highly personal
right.
nature of the data you manipulate.
Right. I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. Approach security kind of from at least 3, if not 4, different ways. We look at it as a personnel issue, and so we screen job applicants. We look at it as an ethics and training issue, and so we address it from that manner continually with staff. Because it's not just, we've got hard copy information around as well as this electronic information. We look at it from a systems basis where we try to ensure that we've got security features hardwired, if you will, in the system itself, and then we look at it from an audit basis. So we are extremely sensitive to and serious about the security, the kind of information that we have. The data quality assurance section, the third bullet there, is 7 limited duration positions, again designed to fix our database errors, ensure cleaner data for benefit calculations and actuarial analysis, and try to help us ensure that when we complete our RIMS conversion, we're moving as clean a data as possible onto the new system. And then the last bullet is just our asset replacement within our information technology group, and that's somewhere around $1.5 million that we'll be faced with as we move forward over the next biennium. Package 107, this is our RIMS replacement, our RIMS conversion package. This is the first 24 months of what will be a 44-month project. We've got an estimated cost of $27.5 million, and that includes a 10% contingency. And we signed that contract last week, so we're formally underway with the RIMS conversion project. This package includes the contracting expenses associated with that, and also 6 limited duration positions that backfill behind our subject matter experts that are assigned full-time to this project to ensure that the business needs are driving the train. We have moved subject matter experts out of each of our business divisions, put them in charge of this project from a business side, working in partnership with our information technology people, and we're then backfilling behind those folks within their operations. So that's what's in that package. Again, all of the positions associated with this package are limited duration in nature. Third major division is our customer service division. Obviously, we're in the business of providing services to both members and employers, and that's the focus of this division. It handles relationships with members, verifying employer reporting, research and eligibility, employer payroll. We also have our publication communication section here. Deferred compensation falls under this division, and then they also process withdrawals, estimates, and purchases. Here we've got, again, package 90. We've got the transfer of our third-party administrative expenses for the IEP, that I account program that I mentioned earlier. This is a contract with City Street. We're going to move that to a different program unit, again, just to make sure that we've got these expenses in the appropriate area. Package 103 is this division's share of the backlog, the accumulated workload. I would point out under this bullet we've got two different types of backlog. One is the loss of membership compliance. We've got about 17,000 people who initiated membership in PERS but never became vested. You have to work 5 years to become vested. After being gone for a five-year period, they no longer earn anything. And so these are, I guess you could call dormant accounts that are no longer generating earnings for those individuals. And it's about $35 million total. Works out to about an average of $2,000, but I'm sure it varies quite widely. And, you know, we've got a responsibility to these individuals, as well as a responsibility under our IRS code, to find them and reunite them with that money. We've got five limited duration positions requested in this package to work on that. We did a test with the new technology, the reverse directories, the internet searches to find people's addresses. We were able to find 70% of the names that we entered in, so we feel pretty good about being able to do this.
Why does that obligation fall to you? Why shouldn't the possessor of the account make contact with you?
Madam Chair, again, as the fiduciary, even though these people didn't establish vesting, you know, we collected money on their behalf, and so you know, under the IRS code, you know, we've got this responsibility. And what's interesting, because our relationship is primarily with the employers, we have employer addresses. We don't have individual member addresses, and we're starting to develop that database. So as this information gets stale, it became extremely difficult for us to reunite these people with their money, but the new technology now has made that a lot easier. You know, anytime people do come to us, of course, we let them know that it's available, but it just is a responsibility that we've.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the private sector, it's been my experience that when you have a cliff vesting, the employer contributions up to that five-year cliff revert back to the benefit of the fund as opposed to the participant.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Morse, same here. All we're talking about is the member contribution. So this is their dollar only.
Okay.
Yeah. The eligibility determination, membership eligibility determination, we've got about 10,000 accounts in that backlog. This is disputes over eligibility and service time. Again, I worked 3 months for you. I worked 3 months somewhere else. I should have been eligible that entire year because I was half-time, and we've got nine limited duration positions associated with that. And then finally, we've got a fee bill, ratification of fee revenue that I believe we'll talk about tomorrow. The breakdowns of those dollars are on page 31. Page 32 is our policy planning, legislative analysis division, business rule team, administrative rules, contested cases, member appeals, legal services, and Social Security. Just two packages here. We've asked for $1 million in other fund limitation to pay for outside contracted legal counsel. Again, this is a continuance of the reform legislation litigation and anticipated contested cases. You might recall that under the reform legislation, it was determined that the Department of Justice may be conflicted in terms of representing the board on that because of their membership in the system itself, and so we were given authority to hire outside counsel. We've hired outside counsel, and we do have cases that are continuing under that. So that's that request there. Package 103 involves our business rules. This is three limited duration positions. Business rules are kind of the building block for our processes and practices. I'll give you an example of one that I was just recently got elevated up to the executive team. A question of how are we going to deal with combined service where you've got someone who's a teacher in the summer, a firefighter in the or a teacher in the during school year, a firefighter in the summer, and a reserve officer during much of the year. And are they police and fire? Are they general service? And so we use this business rules team to work through that. It's critical for both our administrative rules as well as how we are going to program our new technology package. We estimated that we need about 800 business rules for OPSERP, similar to what we've got for Tier 1, Tier 2. We completed about half of those and anticipate the rest in the next biennium. Next division is fiscal services on page 35. And for fiscal services on 36, we've got some restructure and support. Here is where we are asking for one permanent position, and that's our permanent budget manager position to improve our budget analysis, fiscal impact processing, tracking budgets, and the work that this particular section has done on our cost allocation to where we can actually tell you where we're spending money, why we're spending it, project it. We go over this monthly with our board, where we are in terms of positive or negative variances, has been a real improvement over how things have been done in the past. And actually, because of that much refined ability, we were able to absorb some pretty substantial legal and IT expenditures without having to come back to the emergency board, because we could see where we were on an execution basis and knew that we had the resources and the ability to move things around. And so I'm real impressed with the work that our budget management division has done to give us that kind of a tool. And our board is extremely interested in it. We, you know, if you're interested, we could show you the kind of report we give them on a monthly basis. I've worked for boards and commissions for 27 years, and I've never seen a board and commission that's this interested in the execution budget of the agency. So that's good news for people who want to know if someone's minding the store. This package would also continue two limited duration procurement contract specialists. We manage over 75 contracts, and what we've discovered, of course, is that contracting can be very technical and complex, and we need the horses to pull that wagon. This is an interesting one too, and I understand this came up in the DAS budget presentation. You'll see that third bullet. This package continues funding for a DAS state procurement office position. It's one FTE that's in their budget, but the funding is in ours, as I understand it. And what this does is this allows us to handle these highly technical, high value contracts, particularly our information technology contracts, with an expedited review through the Department of Administrative Services. We think it's been money well spent. We did it last biennium. We're proposing to continue it this biennium, and obviously it's always subject to proven value. We get midway through. If we find out that our staff are coming up to stuff, we can certainly assign it in other areas. And then finally, under that package, we've got a limited duration position dealing with accounts receivable. We've got some $2 million that are owed the agency. A lot of it in disputes, primarily employer disputes over whether a member was eligible for the time that they claim that they were working. Our interest, of course, is in closing those accounts out, collecting the money if it's truly owed to us, clearing them off if we agree with the employer. But this is a limited duration position to do that. And then finally, package 104 is just a continuation of our lease of our off-site building. This is a building that's located on 72nd Street in Tigard, about a mile away from our current offices. Central administration, this is my part of the budget. Covers the director and deputy director, board liaison, coordination, health insurance program, internal audits, and human resources. The only packages we've got in here are related to human resources. We've got an analyst adjustment, again, moving the third-party administrative costs for health insurance to Tier 1, Tier 2 program unit out of the operations unit. Package 101 is our one limited duration position in human resources and one permanent position. Here's our second permanent position, strengthening our internal training. And again, what we've discovered is when we bring the new staff on, we need to make them as productive as possible, as quickly as possible, and that requires a comprehensive training approach rather than just relying on people getting on-the-job training. Package 104 is the position associated with the churn, if you will, Madam Chair, that we talked about earlier, the LD positions, as I indicated. We do a lot of hiring associated with those positions, and eventually we will be going through a number of layoffs associated with those positions. The last unit in our budget is our debt service program unit. This is for a certificate of participation on the PERS headquarter building, as well as another COP that was issued for our technology project for HB 2020, the J Clarity project. And this is about $5.7 million total to cover those two COPs. Final page is a wrap-up that shows the entire budget, if you will. We've got our operations, other funds in the first column. That's where we dropped from the $84 million in the last biennium down to $74 million here. Our benefits, other fund non-limited, comes in at about $5.6 billion. Our repayment of debt about $5.7 billion. So you can see total funds of about, repayment of debt is $5.7 million. Total funds is about $5.7 billion. That's kind of a wrap on the budget. I would like to, if I've got a minute, Madam Chair, just to turn to the appendix and cover pages 1 through 8 because we had a question about pending litigation and the Strunk decision. So if you'll look on our high-tech page numbered 1, this was carbon-based high-tech here. We We've got an overview of the Strunk ruling on that page, and you'll see that as I indicated earlier with our summary chart, the Supreme Court held the two aspects of the legislation impair the contract, eliminating annual crediting that assumed rate for Tier 1 members and temporarily suspending COLA, affirmed the redirection of contributions into the defined contribution program, as well as affirm the use of updated actuarial factors, and also concluded that Tier 1 members don't have a contract right to annual earnings in excess of assumed rate. What did that do to us? We factor in that we've got about $2.1 billion added to our unfunded liability. This is the 2.1 out of what you've seen earlier. That estimate of 4.5 and 400 million out of about that five billion. About 1.4 of that was associated with the annual crediting, and about 700 million. Now this is 2.1 as of the 12/31/03 valuation. What I'm finding out in this job is that you always got to reference when you're recognizing liabilities. You always got to reference when you're projecting adjustments to employer contributions. So this grows over time until we pay it off. As I indicate in that last bullet on that page, we're anticipating that we'll have about $1.8 billion after our 2004 crediting in our reserves, and we would anticipate applying that to offset a substantial part of that projected increase. What does it mean to employer rates? We said that if you were to not deploy those board reserves at all and absorb the entire hit effective July 1, you'd be looking at about a 2.4% of payroll effect from the Strunk ruling. With the deployment of reserves, employer rates are going to rise about 0.6% as of July 1, 2007. Again, this assumes no change in the 2005 rates, but I would point out that this is on top of an already scheduled phase-in rate increase, and you're seeing half of that coming in this biennium state budgets, and you'll see the second half of that coming in the next biennium state budget. And I think that what my board is interested in, and you'll probably hear this from Chair Pittman tomorrow, is making sure that people don't forget that you know we are staring at a phased in increase here, whereas the state rate right now may be 8-9% without the pickup. It's going to go up another 5% or so in the next biennium, and you know we want people to make sure they keep that in mind.
I don't think they're going to have any trouble keeping that in mind with the deluge of radio attention that has been paid to it. You might tomorrow. I don't know how closely you're following some of the commentary that has been on the radio, but if there's anything you'd like to use this venue to comment on in response to any of that, I would invite you to do so if you were interested.
I'm sure I don't listen to a lot of radio. I try not to let the newspaper tell me if I'm right or wrong. But if you want to share with me, if you want to,
just leave it there. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, could you just very simply recap again for us the before the litigation Supreme Court resolution,
right.
We were down in the 11% range, and then it's jumped up to the 15%. Range, as I recall,
right.
The numbers.
Right.
And
right.
Now, what you're forecasting is going to impact that. Could you just very quickly recap that again?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Before the reform legislation was passed, we were projecting that the 2003 rates would be somewhere around 17%. And when the reform legislation passed, that dropped them to about 11%. So now, after the Strunk ruling and the recognition of losses that we're still going through, we were projecting for 2004. 5, a rate of somewhere around 19.7% or so. And that's what we're phasing in. I think what's important, Senator Morris, is that, and we've got some charts on this, and I'll try to bring those in tomorrow and maybe walk the committee through those.
That would be very helpful.
Is, you know, you want to start with what were you looking at when you were staring into the hole? And you were looking, actually, we've got estimates that we were looking at 30% rates. So, you know, if we're now going to hopefully plateau out in the 21-22%, and again, that's a kind of a 2-year peak, and I think we've got a chart in here that shows that. You know, you don't want to lose sight of where we thought we were going. Certainly, is it where we'd like to be? No, we would have liked to have not had all the losses, and we would have liked to have some of those earnings that we credited set aside in reserves when we were crediting them, but you know, we are where we are right now. But I'll bring that in, and I think if we can walk through that, it'll help you see where how things have changed, both from a standpoint of the litigation as well as the market. Yes.
Dallas, and then Representative Hawkins.
I just wanted to point out, Chairman, that all of this is on Tiers 1 and 2. That when it's in the radio and everything, all of those numbers relate only to Tiers 1 and 2, and because they haven't factored in yet those that came in under the new plan, because it's too early in the game. So it's not on the entire wage base, is what I'm trying to point out, that for purposes of budgeting, we'll be factoring in every time the ratcheting down, the effect of more and more people being in the new plan.
Representative Avakian, then Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with anything you show us yesterday, or tomorrow, I mean, if you've got the information available, it would be helpful to know what you're anticipating based on the Lipscomb decision being upheld, if it's upheld, rather than just the Strunk. And in addition, going back to pages 22 through 24 or something, the increased staff you're looking at to take care of backlogs.
Right.
Are you anticipating that if Lipscomb is upheld, that additional staff will be able to accommodate that increased workload as well, or will you be before us again looking for additional staff?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, we've got a projection in here, and it's on top of the Strunk staff. Now, the question that I'm asking my managers to look at is there a way for us to triage that workload? If Lipscomb's upheld and we have to start recalculating back to 1999, is there a way for us to triage that and maybe spread it out over a more extended time period? You know, instead of trying to do everything in 2 years, do you do it in 3 or do you do it in 4 years? And some of that is a legal question. Some of that's a management question, because based on our experience, just throwing more people at this workload without a real strong tactical plan, you can end up being pretty inefficient. And, you know, while we like to, of course, turn around, we've got people calling me already and saying, when am I going to get my COLA adjusted, you know, interested in some cases, you know, less than $10 a month, but certainly money that they're legally entitled to, and I want to get it corrected as quickly as possible. But, you know, we'd hope that we could work with the various stakeholders and come up with a reasonable plan that allows us to address the most pressing needs at the front end and work our way through the rest. And you had another question. That was what's the effect on the rates if Lipscomb's upheld? That would reduce rates by another 1.6%. So it can increase them. If the court overturns it, it's already factored in. But if the court upholds the Lipscomb ruling, that would reduce employer rates by 1.6% of payroll. So there were.
Okay, thank you, Chair Jones. It was actually Commissioner Lamoureux from Union County who was crunching the numbers and running those numbers onto one of the radio stations. But he had a question that I'm just dying to know, and perhaps it's confidential, I don't know. Who's the highest paid PERS recipient in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, I think that when you ask it as an individual, as I understand from past DOJ advice, that probably is confidential.
It is.
Yeah.
I'm trying
to
figure out if it was Rich Brooks, Dr. Starr from OHSU. I can't figure out who would have.
It's good that you mentioned some of those names, because obviously this is a system that covers virtually all public employment in this state, and so that includes, you know, your presidents at universities, your coaches, your surgeons and presidents at Oregon Health Science University, your, you know, doctors, lawyers, and everything else across the board, and so you do have people that you know are certainly well in six-figure salaries. And so, you know, retirements in that range are wouldn't be surprising. But
it's a Trivia Pursuit question for the state of Oregon. So anyway, thank you.
In terms of the Lipscomb decision, we do have on page 4 here just kind of an overview of that. Again, we've got several employers that challenged the 99-2001 rate orders. Members intervened on how we allocated 99 earnings. Judge Lipscomb remanded the 99 earnings allocation of the board as well as the rate orders. That's been briefed and argued to the Oregon Supreme Court on November 2004, and we're waiting a court decision. We'd hope that we get that decision this spring, but we've got no control over it. Excuse me. Page 5. We just kind of highlight some of the board actions following the Strunk ruling. We've deferred the decision on 2004 earnings. The board already set aside $1.2 billion in reserves in 2003 and are projected to set aside another $600 million in 2004. We'll calculate transactions on an estimated basis until we get the City of Eugene ruling, because obviously that affects the ultimate calculation. If you're dealing with someone who had an account in 1999 and Lipscomb is upheld and we had credited that account with 20% and we now have to go back in and adjust that crediting down to 11.33, that's going to affect every calculation going forward on the basis of that account. The board went through the necessary budget changes. Unfortunately, we're going to have to delay our annual statements for this year. We'll communicate in other means to members, but we don't want to provide annual statements that have inaccurate account information. And then our actuary went through a detailed analysis of the employer rate components as well as projections at varying investment returns, and we'll bring those charts in and share those with you tomorrow. I would point out here this next page on page 6 gives you an idea of the kind of transactions and the estimated hours related to both Strunk and then the incremental increase under Eugene, and you'll notice that we're estimating that we've got about 4,400 service retirements to recalculate under Strunk. That number jumps to 36,000 under Eugene or under the Lipscomb ruling. And, you know, similarly across the board here, count withdrawals jumps from 2,000 to 9,600, divorce benefits from 2,100 to 4,000. You can see that while people think that, well, all you do is process retirements and maybe a few disabilities and divorces, we've got a number of other activities that are always going on as well, and all of them are affected by account balance and Strunk impacted account balance, and Lipscomb, if it's upheld, will also impact account balance. So that's how we tried to build those estimates. Pending litigation on 7 and 8, I would note that number 2 is no longer pending. That's the Strunk, and we put on there that the decision was issued March 8, 2005, but you've got the City of Eugene that's pending. You've got the federal court case challenging the PERS reform, which is known as the Robertson case. That's now there. The federal court upheld the reform legislation. That's on appeal down to the Ninth Circuit right now. And then you've got
Mr. Clare, let me interrupt you, please. Representative Senator Morse.
Could you identify which ones of these are initiated by the unions?
Well, let's see, Madam Chair, Senator Morse. Number one, we've got both unions and employers involved in that one, City Eugene. The Strunk case was a member challenge. Robertson was a member challenge. White and Canby, we've got both members and employers suing in that. Henderson is a member challenge, and Lundgren is a member challenge. So you've got members in all of them, and employers in two, I believe. Again, some of these cases we expect, now that Strunk has ruled, to either be modified or perhaps to be withdrawn. You know, our interest, of course, is in trying to do what we can to, of course, comply with the laws and comply with any court rulings and minimize future need for people to take things to court. But we are in a business that involves a lot of money and involves a lot of emotion and involves a lot of legal interpretation, and sometimes the courts are the only ways to resolve those disputes, unfortunately. So that's kind of it on the Strunk ruling, the pending litigation. I would point out that within our appendices here on page 9, we cover our five board proposed bills, and all of those have come out of the Senate. I think we had only one no vote on one of them, and are scheduled to come up in front of Representative Brown's committee once they clear the House bills in that committee. These were bills that are housekeeping in nature, and we worked with a legislative advisory committee made up of both employer and member representatives, and that appeared to pay off because we didn't have any problems with these bills on the Senate side. We wanted to show you the extent of our audits and how we're trying to respond to those audits, and that's on page 10. We've got our internal audit recommendations, a list of the audits when they were issued, the number of recommendations, and how much where we are in completing our work in response to those recommendations. That's on 10 and 11, and then our external audits are on page 12. I asked staff about this first one on page 12 because I was concerned that we've got an audit that was issued in June of 2000 and we'd only completed one of the recommendations. We added some bullet points on that. Part of this was a review back when we were in the midst of the wilderness, if you will, on our IT project, and so some of those recommendations were dealt with by us taking a different approach with this commercial off-the-shelf system.
Mr. Clay, I'm going to interrupt you and ask some professional staff to comment.
I'd like to weigh in on that, if I may,
please.
Chair. Your staff here took exception with those recommendations also, that there was a real issue that we had with the report, and people at Audits Division haven't spoken to me since. It was made public through the Information Management Technology and Audit Committee and the Emergency Board. So I would not chastise the agency for not having implemented all of those recommendations.
To the degree, Mr. Cleary, that you're working through these information technology audit recommendations that appear to be somewhat controversial, how much do you rely on DAS information section to help give you guidance, or where are you drawing your technical expertise to address these perceived or real audit concerns?
Well, we've got a good working relationship with DAS IRMD. We use them for quality assurance on our RIMS conversion project. We've actually got an IRMD staffer that we have up at PERS that works on that, gives us that independent review. We work closely with Don's shop on our information security and of course, our equipment issues. I'm not really sure, Madam Chair, on the audit recommendations. I'll check with Jeff today and get back to you tomorrow on that.
I think one of the questions that I have, assuming that the audits division did this, I don't know what particular expertise they have in doing technology audits, so that's a question. When I hear that there may be some discrepancy over the audit findings or at least reason for question about those findings, in this highly technical area, I'm trying to figure out who trumps who. I'm very impressed with the expertise that seems to emanate from Mr. Fleming's shop, and my concern is that if you have folks without unique expertise in doing information technology audits, and there are some questions raised about the audit findings, where is there a venue to negotiate or arbitrate or figure out who's right or wrong in this esoteric and complex area?
Well, Madam Chair, not being there in 2000, I don't have a real good understanding about what occurred back then. I can tell you that as part of our financial audits, the audit division comments on information security and other technology-related matters, and they gave us a confidential letter this last audit period, and our IT staff didn't have any trouble with the recommendations, so they must... What they're doing now at least seems to line up with the thoughts and the expertise in my shop at least.
Well, that's going to be a question that with the commission or the committee's concurrence, I'm going to ask the professional staff to flag, and we will have the occasion, I think, to discuss these information technology audits again. I certainly agree that it is appropriate and probably beneficial to have audits done in that realm, but I'm very curious to know about what constitutes the minimum credentials to be doing such audits, and just given the complex nature of the thing to be audited.
And I'm sure that the audits division would welcome that opportunity to explain what they're doing. Again, what I saw, at least in the 9 months I've been up there, is they have added value to our efforts with their audit findings.
Thank you.
The next page in our appendices just shows where we are on our...
May I stop you one more time? In looking at the 2004 opinion audit, there's 13 recommendations. How substantial are those recommendations on a rating of 1 to 10? If I got a management letter with 13 recommendations in it, it would sure get my attention.
Well, Madam Chair, and the one recommendation that definitely got our attention was the recommendation on the clearing accounts. Because those had been continuing to grow, and the audit division said that's got to be a management priority, and that's why we went with that team of PERS retirees on a half-time basis to work on that. Again, these recommendations were just issued in January of 2005. I can give you our response on those recommendations tomorrow, and you can kind of get an idea of you know, both our agreement with them and what we're trying to do to address them. But this is, I think that when I looked at that and I said 13, my internal auditor said actually for some agencies they see quite a bit more, and I think there's been an increasing number of recommendations coming out of these financial audits. But the only one that was really substantial, at least in their mind and in the mind of that we discussed in detail with our audit committee, was this clearing account issue.
I think the committee would welcome seeing a copy of that management letter just so that we can get a flavor for what the nature of the recommendations are.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Okay.
The page 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 is our affirmative action accomplishments and statistics. This is an area that we're I think somewhat proud of, and also of course recognizing that we have to continue to put forth the best efforts possible to have a diverse workforce actually coming from the natural resource arena. I was very impressed with the diversity up at PERS. We are underrepresented in some areas, but certainly relative to my experience, and some of it I suspect might be in the Portland area. The workforce that we're recruiting from may be a little bit more diverse than the workforce in the Salem area. You know, again, it's an area that attracts my attention on a regular basis, and something that we continue to use these statistics when we're recruiting and when we're evaluating our managers' efforts as well. Page 18, we just wanted to give you an idea about how we're dealing with contracting. These are, I think, as my budget manager told me, are the required information in your budget package. So we cover contracting, ending balances, and long-term vacancies on 18, 19, and 20. And with that, I'm sure I'd be happy to go into detail on any of those or
any questions for Mr. Clary before we move into Ms. Parker's overview of the governor's recommended. There being none, Ms. Parker, I'd invite you to give your name for the record and give us your recommendations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cora Parker from the Budget Management Division. This presentation will be somewhat anticlimactic now that we've heard the agency go through their presentation first, as it was intended to lay some context, but I think it's still important for you before you potentially go to work session tomorrow. Starting on page 2 of the presentation.
And let me just, because we had some committee members join us, today we were open for a public hearing and possible work session. There have been no folks signing up to testify. It is the chair's intention to finish Ms. Parker's presentation, and there being no questions to adjourn for today, Mr. Pittman, the board chair, will be back tomorrow, and we will be noticed for a public hearing and possible work session for tomorrow. Okay. Sorry.
Thank you. No, that's fine. Thank you. Again, starting on page 2, just context for the PERS budget, the administration program area has just over $7 billion of the state's total almost $42 billion budget, and PERS takes up a good chunk of this program area's budget with $5.7 billion. Looking at general fund and lottery fund, however, the PERS budget has no general fund or lottery fund in its direct budget. Page 4 talks about the governor's principal budget. Again, this budget falls almost entirely into the principal related to government efficiency and accountability. Looking at page 5, there's that $5.7 billion total. You'll see that most of that is in non-limited other fund expenditure, and as Paul mentioned earlier, that's related primarily to retirement benefit payments. The operations portion of the budget is approximately 1% of the total, and that's an other funds limited budget. Major sources of revenue, again, are fund earnings and employer contributions, making up that large 99% chunk of that pie. Looking at page 6, again, just a different way of looking at the $5.7 billion budget, the Tier 1, Tier 2 plan, and the retirement benefit payments that are related to that plan make up the biggest chunk of the pie. Again, a minimal amount of activity expected for the OPSERP plan or the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan in the 05-07 biennium. Debt service is a little over $5.7 million, and then operations about 1% again. Because of the fact that the operations or the limited portion of this budget is so small compared to the major chunk of the budget being those retirement benefits, we've broken out here by the divisions, which is what Paul went over today, what that operations section the operations section looks like. You can see that the Information Services Division takes up the largest chunk right now, but again, a good portion of that is related to the RIMS replacement project. Benefits payment and fiscal services are probably the other large section. And I think Paul gave some background on the sorts of activities that are in those sections and why they're larger chunks of the agency's budget. Again, looking at the budget in a slightly different fashion, again, by type of activity, personal services is about $50 million, and that's about $50 million of the roughly $75 million in operations. Debt service, capital outlay, and services and supplies, again, pretty insubstantial compared to the rest of the budget. And you see, again, those special payments or the retirement benefits making up the largest chunk. Looking at the actuals over the last couple of biennia, what was approved in the current biennium, and then the proposal for 0507, you can see in 9901 and in 2001-03 that the agency was sort of what we used to refer to as almost sleepy agency status. I mean, it was an administrative agency. It was fairly simple. It was processing retirement benefits and going along operating rather efficiently. The changes, the reform changes that were made during the last legislative session put a significant workload on top of the agency, and you can see the resources substantially increased over that period of time, both in terms of actual expenditure limitation and in terms of positions required both in the current biennium and in 0507. Major policy issues, again, Paul went over a lot of these. The governor's recommended budget focuses on investments that stabilize and strengthen the agency's operational infrastructure. That's both to shore up fiscal and management infrastructure within the agency. Again, we continue to implement the reform legislation that is in place, and a proposal will be put forth to you as a technical adjustment to bring that up to date to the Strunk ruling. And again, the technology investments that are necessary related to RIMS replacement and movement to the J Clarity are a major portion of the budget. Outside of the direct operational budget, issues that impact that budget are, again, the environmental forces related to PERS, demographic trends, financial performance, budgetary pressures, et cetera, and then, of course, the impact of ongoing litigation. Fee or revenue issues related to this agency. We've got a bill that you'll hear tomorrow, a fee bill related to employee benefit estimate payments, and then, as mentioned a couple of times, both by Paul and myself, a technical adjustment that we're working with the Legislative Fiscal Office to bring to you related to the Strunk ruling. And to clarify, Representative Avakian mentioned this, and Paul addressed it. Any impact related to the potential Lipscomb ruling would be brought forward to you during the interim if necessary.
Any questions for Ms. Parker? There being none, Dallas, do you have any comment before we move towards adjournment for today?
Not for today, Madam Chair.
Senator Morse.
I just would like to point out again the concern for the sustainability of our state budgets when so much of our costs are attributable to PERS and flexible benefits. In doing the calculation for this budget, it's falling pretty much in line with other budgets that look at the total labor and the total flexible benefits and PERS benefits, running about 42%. Some agencies are higher, and I just have real concerns about the sustainability of our budgets in that context.
Thank you very much for that comment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you. A question and a comment. First question to staff and to the chair. Are we approving the policy packages that have been that are part of this budget?
Today we had the review of the policy package by the head of the agency. Tomorrow we will have in front of you the staff recommendation for the policy packages and an opportunity to discuss them at greater length as we move through the staff recommendations. Dallas.
I'll jump in and let you know what my recommendations will be to approve the governor's recommended budget with some minor adjustments only for reduced costs. We know from the PERS rate and from the Attorney General's rate. We're also will be addressing the issue with the Strunk ruling, or the results of the Strunk case. The and I will take the opportunity, if I may, Madam Chair. This is a, and I think we mentioned it earlier, it's certainly in my write-up on the analysis of this budget, that we look at this next 05-07 period as one where the board and new management needs to complete the work that was begun in this 03-05 biennium with an eye towards stabilizing the agency, getting its operations in order, and so that we can come back and look at more to that essential budget level or normalized operations. We were in a period for 03-05 where we virtually had to give them anything they asked for to deal with the reform legislation that was that caused a sea change up there, a radical change in the way they had to do things, not only the number of things that had to be done, but the time frame. And then some of it now is being undone by the Supreme Court ruling, could yet be further undone with another court ruling that could put additional stress on the system. So management is trying to deal with this. They brought in a lot of new management. I would guess this, for a budgetary standpoint, this is a, we look at this sort of a honeymoon period, or as Paul pointed out to me in my offices, this is a period where we're giving them more rope, or additional
new rope.
So that's we can't budgetarily, I think, when you, as you started off with this session, Madam Chair, we're looking at policy issues, and I think your staff would be recommending the policy to let this agency do what it needs to do in 05-07. I think listening to the board chair tomorrow will help give you the opportunity to assess this board's attitude towards agency operations, and you'll get a chance, I think, to hear from Mr. Pittman himself on how what they do really to exercise their oversight and responsibility. That's long-winded.
Is that responsive?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My comment is to agree also with Senator Morse. I have grave concerns about the ultimate impacts of the public employees' retirement system as it's currently structured and as it's being litigated. I do not know how we can adequately fund the issues that may come out of this in the coming years without some major restructuring once again. I see it being death by a thousand cuts for municipal governments, school districts. Somehow we are going to have to address this at some point in time.
Thank you for your comments. All right, we'll give one last call. There were no witnesses signed up on the witness registration. We give one last call for anybody that might be inclined to come down and testify on House Bill 5059. There being none, and absent any additional comments from the panel, I am going to adjourn the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5059 and anticipate that we'll be back here at 8:30 tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.